Ben, sorry for the late start. We were locked out, but we're here. I'm Jordan Steele, Hodson Curator of the University Archives at Johns Hopkins University. This is a collection development opportunity or collections management burden, evaluating the operational impact of collection stewardship. And this session is sponsored by the Conservation Center for Art and Historic Artifacts in the great city of Philly. All right. So, my apologies if you can't see that very well. I'm going to monkey around. Where does this go? There we go. My colleagues, Carrie, Molly, and Molly and I are going to talk for about an hour, which should give us like 20, 25 minutes for Q&A. Unfortunately, one of our original panelists, Matt Francis from Penn State University, couldn't be with us today because he recently accepted a job and is settling into a new role. However, I do want to thank Matt for inadvertently serving as the catalyst for the discussion that we're going to have today. In summer 2017, I attended a conference hosted by Matt and his colleagues at Penn State University. It was this conference. One of the sessions was called Access and Diversity, How to Create Practical, Ethical, Minimal Archival Description. The session was ostensibly scoped to archival description, but I give credit to the presenters for facilitating a broader discussion about the ways in which our allied community of librarians, special collections, curators, archivists, whatever you want to call yourself, can and should apply our shared ethical obligation to provide universal access to collections. One of the breakout sessions of this presentation was led by Matt, and as he reported out about the discussion his group had, he asked some questions that really got me thinking. One of the questions that came out was, to what extent do collecting institutions have an ethical obligation to provide access to the collections they acquire in a timely manner? And if a collecting institution collects at a faster rate than it can responsibly provide access, to what extent does that challenge the foundational ethic of universal access? Put a different way, are our collection acquisitions practices doing right by our collections, their creators, and our users? And what I found so refreshing about this question is that it is a natural extension of important conversations we're having in our various communities about the diversification of the historical record, plugging gaps in archival silences, and so forth. But it took us in a useful direction by questioning the underlying labor implications of our well-intentioned desire to acquire. It is this question that my colleagues and I intend to explore today through a series of observations and case studies. So for my part, I will argue that curatorship, despite its lofty goals of not just selecting but sustaining the cultural record, really in practice and in reality supports a very narrow definition of stewardship. And by stewardship, I mean the post-acquisition activities that are involved in sustaining a collection once it's acquired. And I argue that in response, we might look to the data curation community for a more holistic understanding of curatorship, one that aligns with responsible ethical acquisition of our collections. My colleague Carrie Hintz will provide thoughts about how the feminist ethic of care involves her daily work as a collection steward. And Molly Bragg will close by examining the impact of invisible labor on digital projects. All right, case study time. So I want to start with an acquisition anecdote that unfortunately is by no means anomalous. And I've intentionally obscured some of the details for a few reasons. The people and the collection are not relevant to the point I'm trying to make. I want to avoid the perception that my critique is about an individual performance issue, and that rather it's systemic. And by staying general, you might see your own experience in mine. And if you don't, and you're hiring, I'd love to come work with you. So about a decade ago, one of our curators visited the house of a career scholar of modest notoriety to view the book collection that he had amassed over his career. This scholar had tenuous connection to our institution, having been born and having spent his entire personal and professional life in another part of the country. The collection under review supported a research area that was interesting, but by all estimations niche in our institutional context, as the department that would likely take advantage of the collection only had one or two faculty that would possibly, and I say possibly, incorporate it into their instruction. The book collection was in another language, in another alphabet, translation support for which was not a strength in our library, confined to one paraprofessional cataloger who is already awash in translation projects. So given all of this, you might wonder why we entertained the acquisition of the collection. Well, two reasons. There was a faculty champion, and crucially, there was a dedicated fund established years before to buy collections in this area. Though important to this story, the fund did not fund the labor required to make this collection accessible. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Yeah. The curator reviewing the collection declined to acquire it, a decision that wasn't documented, so I can't tell you why, but you might consider it to be a settled matter. Well, fast forward to a couple years ago. I'd been in my institution for about 6 years, so I wear roughly two hats at my institution. I'm a curator, so I'm the curator of university history. I appraise and select university records, faculty papers, student life materials, and other content documenting university activity. And just a side note in nomenclature, when I use the word appraisal today, I'm not talking about monetary appraisal. I'm talking about evaluating whether something, you know, merits permanent retention because of its value. So I'm a curator, but I'm also the collections manager for anything acquired by the Special Collections Department that's not a rare book or a bound manuscript. So my team is responsible for accessioning, preserving, processing, and providing access to this content. This collections management role explains why I am always involved in post-acquisition activities of manuscripts, archival collections, and so forth. I supervise the people who engage in these post-acquisition activities, and therefore I bear the labor responsibility of those post-acquisition activities. So since the decade or so since this collection had been first reviewed, the academic program that this collection could potentially support had not grown further. The curator who managed the fund from which this collection could be bought had transitioned to a part-time role and works almost exclusively remotely now, dramatically reducing the likelihood that the collection would be incorporated into library instructional sessions. And the paraprofessional in the cataloging department was set to retire soon. But what had not changed, however, was that fund. It was dedicated to buy collections in this area. So since the initial meeting with the creator of the book collection, the family of this scholar had offered as part of a purchase package, to sweeten the deal, I suppose, the scholar's personal papers. When they reinitiated contact with us, there was urgency to finalizing the purchase of the collection because the scholar had passed away and the family was really interested in, you know, selling his house, packing up, and so forth. So our colleague who oversaw the fund agreed to buy everything. So as the person overseeing post-acquisition activities related to the personal papers part of this collection, I was not notified of this until it was a done deal. I was not provided an opportunity to evaluate the collection, to advise on the labor needed to properly provide access to the collection. I was merely informed of the task that lay ahead. So the next few months were very disruptive and expensive for my unit. My processing archivist spent a week at a hotel in another part of the country, making daily trips to the house to appraise and pack up the personal papers. Because the entire house was filled with material of potential interest, this was very intellectually and physically demanding work. Now, ideally, I would have taken the lead as head of the unit to appraise the collection and ask that the transfer of the materials be handled by our processing archivist, who, while a very talented person, was inexperienced with archival appraisal, and it really wasn't her role. However, because my unit was footing the cost of this post-acquisition labor, I made the calculation to keep costs low. If having one professional archivist at a site for an entire week was disruptive, imagine having two, one of whom manages the unit. So our processing archivist really did a commendable job making reasoned, well-informed decisions about what flotsam and jetsam was stuffed in every nook and cranny of the house merited preservation as evidence of the scholar's career. It was a great experience, great learning experience for this person. It should be noted that our colleague who bought the collection provided no direction and was not involved at all in the appraisal process. Despite my encouragement that responsibility be taken to partner with us on this essential work. So appraisal and selection of modern personal papers often results in materials being left on site. Collecting institutions are not warehouses for everything that is conceivably valuable. Tough choices need to be made. So naturally, we left some material on the site. A few weeks after the dust had settled, so to speak, on the project, the family contacted us with concern that we had left historically valuable material on site. In the interest of expediency and cost, which should be noted, had potentially eclipsed the monetary value of the collection we'd paid by that time, we decided to have the remaining material sent to us without review. I reviewed the material over which there was consternation and made the professional judgment right away that my processing archivist made the exact right decision not to include this material. What followed was additional labor and expense to dispose of this material, work that continues to this day and almost 2 years since the gift agreement was signed. So this, folks, is an example of invisible labor made visible for you this morning. And I think my fellow collections managers in the room are probably nodding their heads so emphatically they might get whiplash. I want to repeat that the above case study is not an anomaly. Many of you or your department colleagues have experienced some variation, hopefully better, likely the same, possibly worse. This is not the failure of one or two blinkered and busy actors. Rather, it's a failure to understand and shoulder a more holistic view of curation. So what lessons can be drawn from this? So I think we can use examples like this to critically examine what we mean when we say curator, curation, curatorship, curatorial practice. It may seem like an unlikely place, but I think the data curation community is one we can look to in hopes of redefining or strengthening our understanding about how curation is the intersection and combination of acquisition and stewardship. So there are a lot of definitions out there about data curation. I like this one that the University of Illinois Graduate School of Library and Information Science has. So they say data curation is defined as the active and ongoing management of data through its life cycle of interest and usefulness to scholarship, science, and education. To continue from the slide, data curation activities enable data discovery and retrieval, maintain its quality, add value, and provide for reuse over time. And this new field includes authentication, archiving, management, preservation, retrieval, and representation. Emphasis mine. Notice that these words, authentication, archiving, management, preservation, retrieval, representation, are commonly associated with post-acquisition activities. The data curation community understands that curation is not mere acquisition. Data curators have not just a stake in, but responsibility for the work required to sustain materials in their care. And here's the data curation lifecycle to provide visual context for this concept. There's a lot to take in here. I promised myself that I would never have a presentation where I put some kind of like life cycle thing up there, but first time for everything, I guess. But at a high level, just kind of take a step back and just consider that there's a lot. The point is that there's a lot going on here, that there's a lot bundled up into the concept of curation, and it's very far-reaching. So how can institutions collecting special collections of rare books, manuscripts, archives, learn from the data curation community? In general, we as curators need to assume at least some responsibility for post-acquisition activities, including accessioning, preserving, processing, provision of access, ongoing management. Otherwise, we're not curators, we're acquirers. Acquirers. So my dual role as curator and collections manager, I think, plays a central role in why I apply such rigor and care to the resources I select to be preserved in the archives. Because my staff undertakes the labor to steward these resources post-acquisition, I am impacted. Recently, for example, I was asked if we would acquire the collection of a notable individual. based on consultation with colleagues from other institutions and careful examination of the collection, I advocated that if we were to acquire the collection, we needed dedicated funding at the outset to process it, so it didn't just like go on a shelf and, you know, sit there forever. I was not interested in acquiring an albatross, and I'm happy to say that my request was granted. Yes, it was difficult and it was awkward to temper the exuberance of acquisition with the cold, hard reality of stewardship, but it needed to be done. So how might we diffuse this sense of responsibility throughout our fellow curators? Well, the logic would go as follows. And, all right, stay on this train of logic with me for a second here, okay? If we agree that curators should bear responsibility for post-acquisition activities, perhaps curators should perform some of that post-acquisition activity. Bit of a provocation. So in this scenario, they would be packing up collections, facilitating transfers to libraries, accessioning the collection, arranging and describing the collection in accordance with archival best practice, and delivering the collection to users on an ongoing basis. Now, a curator may quite reasonably reply, I'm sorry, but I do not have the time or expertise to perform this activity. I think that's quite a reasonable answer. So here's my counterproposal. If a curator acknowledges their role in post-acquisition activities and they quite understandably cannot perform them, then the curator should help fund those activities through their collections budget. Now, how might this work? So I proposed at our institution that all collection funds contribute 2% of their endowment payout per year to fund post-acquisition activities needed for the collections that they buy with those funds. Now, I am not so naive to be unaware that this raises some really important legal and diplomatic questions. The first is the fund restricted in such a way to fund solely buying but not other activities associated with the life of the collection? How would curators react to having what amounts to a percentage skimmed off the top of their funds annually? How would creators of those funds, the people who donated the money to set those funds up, react to the fund being established for the purpose of post-acquisition stewardship? I'm not trying to decree an end to the conversation with this proposal, which, as I acknowledge, is a bit of a provocation, but I hope it can be a conversation starter, a way for us to begin to have honest, concrete discussions with all stakeholders about the implications of our well-intentioned desire to preserve the cultural record. So in sum, here's some ideas for how to correct what I argue is an imbalance between acquisition and stewardship. So I talked about the taxing of acquisition funds idea. We also can educate development officers and managers about the importance of funding stewardship, not just acquisition. We should structure gift agreements to encompass not just acquiring, but also stewarding rare and unique materials. We need to ask managers to adjudicate differences of opinion in the acquisition of a collection. We need to create clear collection development strategies and advocate that managers do the tough work to enforce them. I think we could have like a whole session at RBMS about collection development strategies, but I have a lot of ideas about it if you want to talk to me offline. But most important, we need to advocate that positions like processing archivists are core roles, and they're not processing work. You know, post-acquisition labor is invisible, so let's as a community, we need to fix that. In closing, I want to note that there have been some valuable discussions happening in the professional community about invisible labor. There was a session, in fact, yesterday at RBMS. I thought it was great to see that there's not, you know, a couple of sessions here about invisible labor. The idea that there's important work going on behind the scenes and that the right people don't know about it and should. Now, to me, it's actually never really bothered me that much that like the public doesn't understand how the sausage gets made. What really concerns me is when our colleagues don't get it. I don't have time to get it, don't want to get it. These are the people who vouch for us. These are the people who make acquisition decisions that can positively or negatively impact our work. Just as curators are stakeholders in collections management, collections managers are stakeholders in curatorial decisions. If we can all embrace this belief and embrace concrete ways like the proposals I've provided to support, meaning fund, this relationship, I think that we will better bridge that gap between acquisition and stewardship. Thank you.
There are, while we change over presenters, let me know that there are a few seats up front. If folks who are sitting on the floor or standing want to come up, I know that that would be the front row, but they're there.
right. Good morning, everyone. So I'd like to thank Jordan, first of all, very much for his talk and the way that he has laid out the groundwork for how those of us on this panel have been thinking about and talking about the ethical imperatives of stewardship as we've been preparing for this session. It takes some of the burden off of Molly and I to do that work in our presentation and gives us some room to talk about practical strategies we're using to incorporate these ideas and these imperatives into our own work. But I do want to reiterate that while I'll be talking about some specific projects I've been working on, that the work I'm presenting on today and my work in general is deeply informed by a set of ethical principles. As Jordan mentioned, many of those are based on care for our collections and care for people who care for those collections, my staff, my colleagues. I believe that the work of my staff is valuable and that it is my job to make it explicit. And I believe that I believe that access is an ethical imperative. And I believe that we have a real and serious responsibility to be active and engaged stewards of our collections and our resources, human and otherwise. And that it is a fundamental breach of the trust we hold with our donors and our users to accept collection material that we cannot commit the resources to preserving, describing, and making available. I've been doing this sort of work and thinking, and if I'm being honest, sometimes some passive hand-wringing, about the intersections of collecting practices and operations most of my career. The majority of my professional life has been in roles where I oversee manuscript processing or technical services departments. And I've had the privilege of doing this at large, relatively well-funded institutions, organizations that run ambitious collecting programs and bring in thousands of linear feet in any given year. These are places where the ambition of the collecting mission can easily overwhelm the capacity of the staff and the spaces of that organization. So as someone who has long been in a position of managing those staff and those spaces, these questions about how to balance different pieces of our institutional mission to collect, preserve, and provide access to the vital records of our culture are decidedly not academic ones for me. I also recognize that this, of course, is not a new set of concerns. In many ways, it reflects the broader conflict we often see in our special collections units between the curatorial strategies associated with the historical manuscripts tradition and the access mandate of the public archives tradition. Collecting institutions are often stuck in a place where this ideological divide, coupled with chronic understaffing and under-resourcing, lead to an inability to do either preservation or access as well as we would like to. We need practical strategies for enacting responsible collecting and for valuing and prioritizing ongoing collection stewardship. This ongoing stewardship, the cataloging, processing, and managing of collections, the type of work that Hillel Arnold in his 2016 SAA Research Forum talk referred to as the ongoing work of maintaining, is something that we all know tends to be invisible. There have been several articles and think pieces written by our colleagues and by maybe some of you here in this room on the tendency for collection work to be elided through both popular narratives of archival work as a scholar wading through dusty, neglected boxes, and through our own descriptive tools, which de-emphasize our interventions and actions and rely on passive voice declarations that a collection was arranged. But more troubling than the regular New York Times pieces about a scholar's discovery of a fully described resource in an archives, more troubling than that is the way that this collections work, this care and maintenance work, becomes so operationalized that it becomes assumed and invisible within our own institutions and by our own colleagues. We may measure our annual outputs, but we do not see our labor and our time as finite resources to be managed, and neither do our colleagues. Selectors are used to seeing something like a collecting budget as a constraint that they need to work within, but that thinking does not extend to the limits available within an institution to care for collections and to manage them responsibly. So I see part of my job as making this work explicit, not only to researchers and external parties, but to my colleagues and to my administrators. As part of this, I've been developing a framework in which to use these deeply operational matters as a way to advocate for ethical collecting practices and to highlight how collecting work has real and measurable impacts on an institution and its staff. There are two tightly related projects I've been working on recently to develop this operational impact framework for assessing potential acquisitions. One is focused on workflows in my own institution, and one is thinking about how to broaden that work to develop some tools for the larger community. So this past year or so, I've been working with the curatorial team and my administrators at my institution to develop a strategy for making the labor of technical services staff and the operational realities and constraints of our shop part of the criteria that we use when assessing and making decisions about potential acquisitions. New collection proposals now require an operational impact statement that outlines the amount of time and work that a new acquisition will require in order to make it accessible and the costs associated with that work. This form is included in the proposal when curators pitch new collections, and it helps to ensure that if we decide to acquire something, we are making an informed commitment to the ongoing maintenance and responsible stewardship of that collection and others in our care. Getting to this point has been a bit of a process, so a little bit of history. Like I'm sure is true for many of you, more and more of our new collections contain or consist entirely of media and formats that are not analog paper-based documents. Some of this is, of course, because of the overall shift towards more records being created electronically. But in my library, it also reflects a very particular set of collecting strategies and an intentional choice on the part of our curatorial team to take an expansive view of what constitutes a record. In our shop, this is particularly manifesting in our collecting much more heavily in visual culture, including artist papers, photography collections, and mixed media pieces. Many of these types of collecting present clear management challenges due to the housing and storage needs of these types of collections, preservation requirements, and often their very materiality and instability as physical objects. So this collecting shift has begun to force conversations about what it actually takes to care for a particular collection, both in terms of cost and in our ability. So when one of our curators was trying to acquire a collection that consisted almost entirely of Polaroids, our director and associate director were kind of like, this sounds like a great collection, but you gotta talk to Carrie before we can okay this. We just hadn't dealt with instant print photos on this scale before, and we needed to figure out what sort of preservation and access needs we needed to be thinking about. Additionally, I just didn't know that much about the stability or instability of Polaroids. Were these going to even be around? You know, if we're contemplating acquiring a collection that's going to disappear in a few years because of the medium, that's a pretty bad investment by any count. So we just needed more information. So the curator dutifully came to talk to me. We're talking. I did some research, I talked to a conservator, and then I wrote up a memo for the curator that outlined some of the key things I learned that may impact his decision about whether or not to move forward with the acquisition. What this might mean in terms of additional costs to the unit to house the collection, and what expectations we were going to need to have in place around the storage, use, and display of these photographs. We then had a really good conversation about the documentary value of the collection, the uniqueness of the subject matter, where we were at in terms of the research and field, the research interest there. And after a frank cost-benefit analysis discussion about the collection, which we did end up acquiring, both of us walked away with a better understanding of the nature and value of the collection, its needs, and our ability to properly steward it. I also walked away from that conversation thinking, of course, we need to be doing this all the time. Collection services needs the chance to weigh in on new collections and our ability to responsibly manage them. There are so many frustrations and misunderstandings that could be mitigated by talking about these issues at a pre-acquisition stage. And I very much wanted to formalize that conversation that we just had and to come up with a mechanism to share with selectors both what our capacity in collection services is and what kinds of invisible or ongoing costs or broader implications may be associated with an acquisition that someone may not be aware of or think of. These broader implications are especially critical since the ongoing care for collections is so often distributed across the library. Increasingly, our collecting activities are having ripple effects on other administrative and functional units within the libraries and library system. Collecting patterns established in special collections put at the very least an implicit, but often an explicit, claim on the time and expertise of staff members responsible for conservation, digitization, off-site storage retrieval, digital preservation, and it goes on. We desperately needed a better way to collect and share information about potential acquisitions with other library units that would share the responsibilities of caring for and stewarding these materials. And we needed to do that in a way that's more reasonable and respectful of our colleagues' time and expertise then showing up with a signed deed of gift that says that they're now responsible for doing a massive digital project, and it needs to be done in 6 months. And I think we've all seen those types of situations. But it wasn't necessarily making us a lot of friends in the library. So I took this conversation and I created a template, drafted a report, and suggested that all major acquisitions should undergo this review before being considered for acquisition. I pitched that this was a decision-making tool, and the group could use it to more fully understand the impact of collecting decisions in the unit in the library. So I'm the one who drafts the form based on information gathered from curators. The form looks like this. It's pretty straightforward and simple. And the fields that we cover are things like the one-time costs of transferring, cataloging, or accessioning and processing a collection, ongoing storage costs, both digital and analog, format questions, such as does it have AV in the collection that we're going to need to digitize or manage somehow? Is there born digital material? And if so, we have a separate questionnaire to get a little bit more information about what types of born digital content and media we may have in a collection. And it gives us the opportunity to raise any additional questions or concerns or to bring up any questions we might have for a donor that would assist us in describing a collection. So as for the reception of this new initiative, unsurprisingly, as the people who both manage interlibrary relationships and who manage library budgets, my administrators were very on board with being more intentional about assessing the ways that a new acquisition could impact our operations. Thanks, administrator. When you're paying the bills, you're very aware that there's a significant difference between the real cost of shipping, accessioning, and arranging and describing a 4-foot collection or a 400-foot collection. And that something like a purchase price is just the beginning of a conversation about what an institution is investing in a collection. The reaction among the curatorial team was a little bit more tepid, especially initially. I think it was met with cautious acceptance. You know, there wasn't real pushback, but there were some questions about how much utility this would have for them, and also some concerns that this could be used to take away some of their autonomy or to find reasons not to accept a collection. And it has resulted in not making acquisitions we otherwise might have. The longer we've been using it, though, the more value everyone is seeing in doing this sort of upfront analysis of acquisitions. There's been really good uptake in thinking about this as a negotiating tool with donors and a way to go in and say, here is the real cost of what we are willing to invest in your collection, and here is the value that we are bringing, we as our collection services team and we as a library can bring to this. And it shows a serious commitment on the part of the library when we're talking to new donors. It's also been a really great way to initiate a conversation with donors about what happens to their papers after the boxes are packed and sent to the library, and to really be able to help them understand what to expect and what it means to have your papers move into an archives. So I mentioned this form very much in passing last year during an RBMS panel on assessment and data collection, but I got a ton of questions and feedback about this document. There was a lot of interest in the process of assessing operational impact and making ongoing, intentional, and principled stewardship a larger part of the professional conversation. So shortly after the meeting, a small cohort of folks in similar roles, collection management type roles as I have, so some folks at Harvard, Yale, and later Duke, began talking regularly about the challenges we are facing in our own institutions, managing our staff, our spaces, our backlogs, and resources, and grappling with some questions that were coming up in our work. How do we make sure that our labor is a factor in collecting decisions? How can we effectively communicate our value and also our limitations to key decision makers in our organizations? And how do we measure or determine that in the first place? And also, if we're struggling with this, can we assume that others are too? And there might be some benefit for trying to systematize this and develop some tools that can be broadly applied. To this end, we've begun to develop a two-pronged model for how to think about the overall impact of an acquisition, a total cost of ownership model and a capacity constraint model. We see these as two distinct but related ways to assess collections and their real-life impact. The total cost of ownership includes things such as purchase price, shipping costs, costs associated with accessioning, processing or cataloging material, supplies, labor costs, annual storage, physical or digital. And this would give us an understanding about what kind of long-term investment in a collection means for an institution's bottom line. As so many of our institutions are chronically under-resourced, these budgetary considerations may help us make hard decisions about what we can and should collect, and to better understand whether we have the ability to manage and care for the collections in a manner consistent with our professional obligations. Or if Jordan's proposition for acquisitions budgets being allocated to help fund ongoing collection maintenance, it would be useful to know how much that costs. The capacity constraint model, credit for which goes to one of my collaborators, Matthew Beacom at the Beinecke, is a model for defining the limits of what we can reasonably do in a given time period, given existing resources of staff, space, other obligations and projects, etc. And building those limits into both annual planning discussions and collection development decisions. So for example, how many staff hours do we have available in a given year for processing? How many linear feet can get processed in that time period with that number of hours? Can we think about that cap the same way we would think about an annual budget cap? We have X many number of hours available for collection description, maintenance, and care projects, and we cannot take in any collections beyond our capacity to care for them in a given time frame. So when the hours to manage collections are gone, we've reached our annual limit. Clearly defining our capacity could be a powerful strategy for preventing backlogs through collecting within our institutional means. Understanding what we can reasonably do may also be a strong advocacy tool for helping administrators understand any gaps between our current capacity and what resources may be needed to actually manage our collections. For example, in going through this project and crunching some numbers, I recently figured out that given our current staffing constraints, I have a 70-year print cataloging backlog. I also now have a check from a donor to fund additional cataloging support. It certainly doesn't solve all of our backlog problem, but being able to articulate a very specific need in terms that make it clear that this is not a matter of working smarter or working harder, but is the result of a measurable imbalance between our investment in collection material and our investment in cataloging staff, that made a compelling case for some support. These last few models that I mentioned are something that my collaborators and I, like to turn into an article and a set of tools, perhaps something like the excellent DLF digitization cost calculator. And they're still very much in development. So if there's anything you would find useful in a tool like this, or you have any great ideas, please hit me up in the Q&A or after this session. But I do think that these efforts that I've been talking about today point to some beginnings of practical ways that we can shift our thinking about the relationships between collection development and collection management. These functions cannot continue to be seen as independent activities. Selectors and administrators need to understand the significant resources and talent that we expend on collection care and maintenance, and the stewardship obligations that their collecting practices impose on others. We need more thoughtful strategies for assessing the lifecycle management needs for our collections, and to be ever aware that our obligations to our collections, donors, and users begin, not end, when material enters our door. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you to Jordan and Carrie for your excellent perspectives and for including me on this panel. As they mentioned, I'm here to talk specifically about operational impacts around digitization and digital collections. As head of digital collections and curation services at Duke, I provide digitization services to Duke libraries primarily, as well as other campus partners. The library's digitization program focuses almost exclusively on digitizing special collections from the Rubenstein Library, but I am actually a part of the Digital Strategies and Technology Division. I strongly believe that providing services in libraries is a partnership that should be mutually beneficial to everyone engaged in both providing and utilizing services. This point of view informs my desire to be a good partner within the library and a reliable and effective collections steward regardless of my position in the institutional hierarchy. Before I move into my case studies, I want to first point out that to me, a digitization project is not synonymous with scanning. Scanning happens all over the library, both at our public scanners and within departments that provide electronic loans or assist remote patrons. The differentiating factor between scanning and the digitization program I manage is that we engage in a series of activities that encompass pre-digitization preparation, digital preservation, metadata, and in most cases, online access to the public. A lot of steps, not just scanning. I think of Duke's digitization program as an assembly line, and scanning is only one stop on the conveyor belt. I like this metaphor because our work is a complex process that usually happens in a specific sequence and is performed by highly skilled professionals. These are archivists, conservators, developers, metadata professionals, and of course the digitization specialists and student assistants that carry out the actual scanning. Without the whole team and the whole process, we would not be able to successfully provide public access to so many collections. I'm sharing two short case studies today that illustrate the often overlooked operational impacts of my work with digitization projects. I had many to choose from. For example, Carrie referenced donor-driven digitization, where the collection comes and it's like, surprise, you have to digitize it. I have some fun lists, maybe over drinks, I can share some of those. The first case study that came to mind when Jordan approached me about this panel is my institution's recent experience with vendor-driven digitization projects. I'm thinking specifically of projects where a vendor like Adam Matthew or Gail Senyage or take your pick, approaches a library to digitize a collection or collections and then provides access to those collections to their subscribers, and the library receives some portion of the subscription revenue. I understand the value in these projects quite clearly. They provide an excellent source of funding, opportunities for digitization where they may be few and far between. They get collections to more researchers. And often, the vendor is willing to do fairly arduous work. In our case, that work included numerous rights clearances that the library has not been able to take on itself. The downsides of these projects, however, cannot be overlooked, and I feel like a real killjoy when I repeat them time and again to my colleagues. First and foremost, these projects are, in fact, digitization projects. The assembly line is still required, and the process must be managed, even if someone else is going to perform the scanning. Also, the resulting digital collections end up behind a vendor paywall for an embargo period. This is where we get into an ethical quandary. Do we want to spend precious library resources on digitization projects that results in a paywall for our patrons? One of these projects came to fruition at Duke in the last 2 years. Going into it, we knew we would have to plan for 3 new operational impacts unique to this situation. First, in addition to the usual pre-digitization collection review, which is performed to ensure the items are stable enough to withstand the digitization process, Conservation Services plan to carefully review items coming back from the digitization vendor as well to make sure they were not damaged. We have had items damaged in earlier versions of this type of project. Second, we also vet the digitization vendor to ensure that they follow preservation standards and have experience working with rare and fragile materials. Did I mention we had damage in a previous project? Another important aspect of vetting vendors involves learning how they track what they are digitizing and if we can influence that process. In other words, we want to know if they fill out their spreadsheets the same way we fill out our spreadsheets. This is important because if we do not know which files come from which part of the collection, it will be very difficult to manage the preservation of those files in the long term. How many of you have vendor hard drives sitting on someone's desk at your library and you don't know what to do with them, nor are even sure what's on them? If you don't, your colleagues do. Part of this extra setup
part of this extra step at conversation is to avoid that scenario as much as possible. Third, in this project, we asked the vendors to perform digitization on site. That meant that the library had to dedicate a room for the duration of the scanning period, which was projected to be over 6 months. This turned out to be a pretty non-trivial part of the project, as there was a big hiccup with the room we had planned for them. As a result, we had to set up a new room at the last minute, which involved locating the room, painting it, and replacing ceiling tiles to create a digital studio. Administrative services, facilities management, and one of my digitization specialists contributed to the planning and monitoring of the work, and I have no idea how much that cost or who paid for it. There were aspects of the project that worked really well. In the past, projects like this have happened with little coordinated communication or knowledge. This time, the project was formally proposed to our Digital Collections Advisory Committee, just like all the other digitization projects. Having the committee vet the proposal ensured that, one, everyone actually knew the project was happening, and two, we could discuss and plan for the resulting operational impacts, as we would most other digitization projects. We also requested compensation from the vendor for the departments that were directly involved. Conservation Services requested funds for their time, and my unit digitized parts of the collection due to its age and condition, and provided previously digitized portions of the collection to the vendor, and we were compensated for both efforts. There were, of course, some unforeseen issues as well that came up. I already mentioned the startup issues with the room. Even after the digitization vendor got up and running, there were more questions directed to my staff than I anticipated. Most of this was technical and directed at my digitization specialist, which interrupted his other duties. No one question was overly burdensome, but taken as a whole, there were quite a few, and most of them seemed urgent, given the urgent nature of the project. I appreciate that some of our work was directly compensated, however, not all of it was, and that time could have and should have been spent on other projects. All in all, we learned a lot from the experience. More of these projects are coming, and now we have a better idea of the trade-offs inherent in them and their operational impacts across the library. I had a conversation with a colleague just this past Monday about a possible vendor-driven project that is on the horizon. This time around, we may be able to scale back some of the distributed work by making strategic choices about what items and collections we include and who participates in the process. Perhaps we can scope the project so its champion can provide resources to select and vet materials and therefore not require as much of our conservator's time. This is similar to what Jordan was saying, where you ask your curator to do some of the work or pay for it. Or maybe we'll use the same digitization vendor that we already know and understand. Regardless, I feel that I have made progress in convincing my colleagues that these projects are, in fact, digitization projects and that they require management as such if we want to keep our collections safe and prevent the project's output from life as a hard drive on someone's desk. Having these digitized files, after all, is a significant benefit to the library in addition to the financial gain. So that's case study number one, and here's case study number two is about technical debt and our digital collections interfaces. I'm going to change gears a little bit. As you can see from this very scholarly Wikipedia definition, technical debt happens when one puts something online in a slapdash fashion that results in an engineer or somebody owing the product more work in the future. My experience with technical debt is a little different than that. With Duke Digital Collections, we have put ourselves in debt by over-engineering our interfaces. At Duke, we have a history of creating digital collections with homegrown, complex, and customized interfaces and metadata that differ from project to project. I certainly don't mean to throw my colleagues under the bus for doing so much customization. This practice dates back 10 or 20 years or more, and these projects were highly successful at the time and continue to be so in many respects. It is only in the past 3 or more years that we have been intentionally addressing our customization tendencies. My library's developer resources are in high demand, not just from digital collections, and that means we are not able to devote a tremendous amount of effort to proactive maintenance. So over time, our complex digital collections interfaces suffer. We have had links and web pages that are powered by fancy metadata break, and it has been too time-consuming to fix them. We also have web pages that don't break, but they suffer from neglect all the same. It's a sad story. For example, our student newspaper digital collection first went online about 6-ish years ago with issues from the 1960s. We continued to digitize, so we periodically need to add more issues to the digital collection. Unfortunately, every aspect of the process is extremely time-consuming. The interface includes full-text indexes exported from ContentDM that is then routed into a homegrown layered interface. Only one person really knows how to do the whole process from end to end. Even a seemingly simple web page that facilitates browsing by date is extremely labor-intensive to update. As a result, it is not updated as often as we would like, and when it is a huge undertaking that is difficult to prioritize among all our other important web interfaces. For example, there was like a very important event that happened in 1968, and for whatever reason, we missed that issue, and so it wasn't on this page, and then the 50th anniversary came up, and it was like, where's that issue? How do we get to it? And we couldn't add it to the date because we couldn't rise to the top of the priorities. There is some light in the tunnel, however, and we are slowly working our way out of debt. In recent years, we hired a metadata architect to work in digital strategies and technology. Part of our work has been to standardize the metadata application profiles in our digital repository. That means as we move digital collections into the repository, we conform metadata and the collection to a common profile and interface configuration instead of creating different functionality for each and every collection. Any exceptions or changes from our profile are rare. They are managed carefully and only approved for extremely strategic projects. Thus, they are the exception and not the rule. This is a huge step forward for us, and the hope is that we will be able to manage and sustain our collections and systems more efficiently and effectively. There is still some highly customized code on the back end, but hopefully migrating the actual collections and metadata will be much easier when the time comes. And it will come because there's always another systems migration coming. There is a downside to our debt reduction program. At times, we have had to renegotiate the metadata for a collection and scale back its structure when we migrate. This has been cause for some difficult conversations with collection champions as we explain why it is unwise to create a dozen extremely customized metadata fields that will only benefit one or a small number of collections. Our most convincing arguments has been to point to where the old digital collection broke and was never fixed. In our new system, metadata functionality isn't as fancy, but it is harder to break. That works, but it is always difficult to take functionality away from our colleagues and end users, even when it is in the service for the greater good. While we feel really positive about our new approach, migrating collections into the new standards can take a tremendous amount of effort. We need to review and remediate the existing data and description, map metadata to the new application profile, and then ingest everything into the repository. Tools like OpenRefine make it easier to clean up metadata, but it is still a time-consuming process. Remediating the scanned data can also be a hands-on, arduous process that takes time away from scanning. We balance the migration work with our new projects, which means it moves extremely slowly. While we're bringing as many of our digital collections under the digital repository umbrella as we can, we still have a number of collections spread out across different access systems. We have content on Internet Archive, ContentDM, and several homegrown platforms. We provide links between the catalog or finding aid and these platforms so end users have as seamless a browsing experience as possible. However, some of these systems require maintenance or money, and we would prefer to consolidate when it is feasible. Consolidating, of course, has its own trade-offs because some of these platforms have their own value, which is not replicated elsewhere, and therefore we are reliant on it. For example, we are dependent on ContentDM for full text indexing, which is an ideal way for using text-heavy collections like those student newspapers. As a result, we are hooked on ContentDM until we find a new way. Another example along these lines is our earliest digital collections platform, the Digital Scriptorium. Can you tell this was created in the 90s? Despite the lack of modern functionality, such as structured metadata, these sites are very effective for researchers. They have transcriptions, in-depth information about the collection, and of course the scanned images. However, they're not integrated into our discovery systems. The provenance isn't always clear, so it is hard to find the actual papers that are... Oh my God, I'm missing a page. Oh. Thank you. So, as I was saying, the provenance isn't always clear, so it's hard to find the actual papers that are displayed. They have low-res images, and that fun vintage aesthetic does not necessarily reflect well on our institution, given our other modern interfaces. I'm a bit embarrassed to even show this today. Somehow, researchers still use these pages, and often, so we have to maintain a few of these. As you can imagine, the Scriptorium projects were created using a completely different mindset than our current approach to digital collections, given that our method for migrating these has been to just reconceptualize the whole project and start over. Here's when we did in the last year. We even modeled the transcript, and those links on the right link the patron to the catalog and finding aid so an end user can request the real thing very easily. Moving forward, we do not have a comprehensive plan to address every last one of the 90s relics. That is because the operational impact to do so has not yet outweighed the need to devote resources to new projects or digital collections that are already in the process of migrating. I do believe that we will address every last one of those Scriptorium sites in time, but I think it will be years before that process is complete. I want to close my remarks by emphasizing the same metaphor I've drawn on throughout this presentation. The care and feeding of a digitization or digital project is a complex operation and triggers an assembly line of work. We should not forget that, and we should use these resources sustainably and in a way that is beneficial to all. Thank you.
Okay, we have the session's over 12:15, so we've got like quite a while to ask to field questions. And I think if you want to ask a question, please use this microphone that's on the right here. By the way, Molly, just an anecdote before we get to Q&A. So I went to grad school at UNC, and about 15 years ago, in a class, we talked about Duke's Digital Scriptorium and how dated it was. It's not a judgment, it's just an observation, you know?
Yeah, so,
Anyway.
No, but we've reduced the number. There were a lot more.
Yeah, that was a great trip down memory lane.
Yeah, so. You should look at the HTML code for those.
All right, I will. Questions, comments?
Somebody. We have like extra ones, so. Yeah, please use the mic. Oh, this is taped down.
It's not why I took you over. It's not why. It is an hour.
So we'll repeat the question.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, I feel special. good morning. My name is Erica Witt, and I represent Southern University at New Orleans. We are one of the HBCUs here in the city. So what I have to say is kind of long-winded, and it's going to turn into a question, I promise. Like most people, I also work in the different capacities at my institution because of the lack of resources, as well as trying to not so much as merge different departments, but unifying them in a sense so they can learn to work better together. So I am the circulation librarian for our library, of course, curator or curatorial specialist for a traditional African art collection that we do own, as well as an adjunct professor too. So I do a lot of things, but we completely lost our archival collection in Katrina, and then the art that we have today also sat in the water for about a month. Luckily, we had museum studies students, which we have the only museum studies program in the state, along with a conservator to go through and rehabilitate what they could salvage. So now I care for those things in my office, weirdly, but anyway, I digress. I found your operational impact statement to be very valuable. Would you be interested at all in sharing that information, or is there somewhere like a website that we could go to retrieve that information, or just any way that you'll be able to share that? So, for example, with the people at my school, they enjoy collecting things without realizing all the things that it takes for me to have to be able to make space within our collection / my office. to make that space, as well as how I have to care for it when I'm not doing everything else on campus. So would you be willing to offer any kind of advice to any of you, but also just to share that resource to be able to help us out as a university?
Thank you. Go ahead and shoot me an email or something like that, or we can touch base. I'm probably putting it up someplace more widely available is a good idea.
Yes, please.
I haven't done that yet.
Yes.
So I'm more than happy to share that. And like I said, part of the project that I have going on with some of my other colleagues who are in similar positions as I'm in is thinking about making a sort of small toolkit like that that has an example of that, operational impact statement, the types of questions we use, but then also some kind of calculator that helps us determine, based on our staffing costs or things like that, how a tool that we can actually use to calculate what those would be so that we can fill that out effectively. So that is still a little bit down the line, but it is something that we're planning on doing to make broadly available and to share with the community and to put out there. But in the meantime, more than happy to share anything that I have and to kind of get that out there as a rubric and a way of thinking about and assessing a tool for talking with our colleagues who do collecting about what this means and to be a little bit more strategic about that.
Looks like that mic is working.
Yes, thanks.
Yep.
It is really working. Thanks to these folks over here. Thank you. Okay.
I acknowledge John.
There we go. Yes, thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. I am Rachel D'Agostino, and I am the curator of printed books at the Library Company of Philadelphia. And I tell you that because though my title is curator, I spend way more time on collections management than on collection development, which is great. I'm happy to do everything, to do it all, whatever. I don't do it all by myself. I have loads of staff, relative to our total staff, who do this work of processing and stewardship, et cetera, et cetera. But I am really interested in issues around budgeting for the stewardship work. And this is my favorite RBMS session of all time. I'm so excited to hear from all of you. This is fantastic. But I have so many questions. One of them is for Jordan about the essentially the tax on the acquisitions budget for stewardship, and I'm just wondering where you came up with a percentage, like what data did you use to decide what percentage of the acquisitions budget would actually cover stewardship?
and I'm not in love with the idea of taxing the acquisitions budget, but what I am in love with is getting new ideas for how to talk to administration about budgeting for adequate staffing positions. So I'm interested in, A, what data you use to come up with that percentage, and B, this is more for Molly, talking about, or actually Molly and Carrie, talking about coming up with ways to budget if we anticipate the costs from this survey and from other data collected from digitization projects. How do we use the impact survey, not so much to negotiate with donors, who I find are really receptive to giving us money to help with stewardship, but to negotiate with administration for actually using that money or anticipated money for budgeting in future years? And finally, I know I'm going on, but do you consider telling potential donors it's going to take us, we need to get to another budget cycle before we can do this work of stewardship because we need to actually budget it in and get the staffing? I'm sorry, I know that's a lot, but this was great. Thank you.
So about the tax idea, so I regret to say it was pretty unscientific. What it was informed by is, to a great extent, was we generally get like a 2-3% increase in our collections budgets across the library every year. So that was just a number that like, it was a percentage that people had some familiarity with. I also should say, like, I might have made it sound, my proposal sound more formal than it was. It was really just me talking to my boss, and, you know, we were kind of brainstorming ideas. So that's how I came up with the number.
Okay. And the question for us was about budgeting our operational impact, is that? Okay. So one thing, this is something I haven't done yet, but my director of administrative services really wants me to, is to come up with, they have like a form and a way to do it at Duke where you come up with your service cost, and it's a fancy spreadsheet, but you break down, it's like a workflow analysis, and you look at how much time you're spending on X activity. It looks at, we're encouraged to look at all aspects of our costs. So, for example, we looked at one of my workflows, and she wanted me to include the people that that retrieve the box and get it to us for, like, patron digitization and things like that. Because it's true, we have to wheel a cart through the back of the stacks. It has to come out the airlock. We have to meet them because the door only opens one way. And we have to put that on our calendars. So that cost, we have an appreciation schedule for all our digitization equipment, so that factors in. And so sometime in the next year or so, we're going to be really sitting down and doing those service costs, which will then be this amazing number that I can say, it'll be like my own internal DLF digitization cost calculator that I'll be able to say to vendors and to curators and to anybody, our costs are, if you want me to do these things, this is an actual real cost, instead of the like kind of real unscientific way I've been trying to account for my costs for grant applications and for donors and things like that. So I'm looking forward to that. I hope that helps answer your question.
Yeah, and I would say for us, the way I think about cost, and especially in terms of my folks' time, is going through and looking at what percentage of their time tends to be spent on a particular activity within a given week, and kind of extrapolating from there based on an average salary. So I look at that's how I've done that, and definitely use this as a planning tool for thinking about what work we can do, when we can slot it in, what else is coming down the pipeline, and we will talk to donors and encourage the curatorial community to talk to donors about that too. Mm-hmm. So if they have a priority project, we can still say that based on what the other things that you have already prioritized on, you know, my folks' time, this is about the time frame that we can look at, and so we can tell them, like, the donor, that this project is not going to happen until XYZ fiscal year or, you know, time period.
You know, we've done the salary calculator too. Mm-hmm. Just a pro tip about that: make sure you tack on the benefits burden of the university, so it's not just the annual salary. You know, our benefits burden is something like 34%. So what you should do is take that annual salary and times 1.35. I feel like that's tattooed sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the things that's baked into our thing as well, is the percentage of time.
I have to make this a little shorter. I'll just be a lounge singer here. Thanks, guys. This was really great. Wonderful things to think about in combination. I'm Katie McCormick. I'm the Associate Dean for Special Collections and Archives at Florida State University. In our organization, we don't have staff, sort of a broad enough staff to be split into the kinds of units you've been speaking of. So we don't have selectors. We don't have curators who are distinct from those who do processing. We have a collections management group who also, and everybody participates in public services. And so in thinking about stewardship and the division of labor and calculating these costs, I think we do, in an ideal world, sort of an attempt to make more sharing in that information, and there's still imperfections in that. So my question is, in this process, and particularly in thinking about the ethics of stewardship of material, and Jordan, you brought up sort of what's reasonable time when we accept a collection to make it accessible. I wonder what conversations you've had about levels of stewardship, right, and giving up control, or our needed concepts that all stewardship is at the highest level of processing and access and other things and time and attention, and what challenges or successes you've had in those conversations when you're assessing the data to set time frames and negotiate what access means and what stewardship means along that process, and if that's resulted in any changes in your ability to calculate those costs and get help to do things.
Well, I can jump in really quickly. We do have four clearly articulated levels of processing at my institution that we draw on that we can use to make those decisions. So everything that comes in, we do some baseline processing at the time of accessioning, and we consider that for the most part. Most of the things in our collection that is accessible and usable, and that is sort of our step one. And I calculate that as the sort of the baseline accessioning cost. Like, this is what we have to take into consideration with any collection that we bring in. And then we'll have a conversation with the curator about if you want to describe at these other levels, if that's going to be our plan for that, then the processing time frame and cost would look like this. So we have a pretty clear rubric in our institution. And if Jordan has the fringe rate, like, I'm very much like going back and doing iterative extensible processing and talking about different levels of acceptable stewardship, and processing is very much baked into our operation.
We, in our process, we don't. Some of our processes are, some parts of our process are lent more to that perspective than others. Like, you can't like digitize light. Kind of just digitize or you don't. But you know, we have projects that are really meant to be lower overhead in terms of project management, metadata. We also, you know, we really take our cue from the processors. So if they don't feel like it requires item level metadata, there's no way we're going to put like that. We're going to somehow create it on our side. So we work in concert to do that, and with access services to make sure things are right going into the process. That's a change. We used to do way too much metadata. And then with preservation, again, it's for the digital preservation, we sort of look at that like systematically. So all the things we're preserving digitally, and there's really, there's not a light version of that either. So, yeah.
I don't have anything else to add. I mean, those were great responses. One thing I will say, Katie, is I want to emphasize that I am sensitive to the fact that there's a tension between a quite reasonable ethical obligation to preserve the cultural record, so to collect the cultural record, document experiences in the cultural record, and the ethic of providing access in a timely manner. There are no easy answers.
Mm-hmm. Hi, my name is Caitlin Wells, and I'm the Collection Services Librarian at the Special Collections Research Center at the University of Michigan. And actually, Katie got my question, but I was also wondering how you've discussed with curators, in addition to MPLP, maybe any sort of changes that you would make. For example, I'm new in my position, and you know, changing existing description practices to make them work efficient, and having to explain, you know, we're not cataloging scrapbooks now, we're making finding aids. We may make finding aids for book or ephemera collections where previously we would catalog them, and how you can kind of overcome those resistance. And I'd also like to add that I agree this is a fantastic session, and thank you so much for hosting it.
The one thing I think that's been really helpful that I've tried to do the last few years is basically basically let our curators know that when a collection enters the institution, it will not be available for them to access until we put in the time and effort to make it available. So, you know, there used to be situations where collections would come in, they would go into someone's office, they would not be processed because there wasn't, you know, investment in that, and a curator would go into the office and like pull the collection, and I've tried really hard to kind of put the kibosh on that. So that's one way to kind of like introduce a certain, I mean, it regrettably negatively impacts their ability to access the collection, but it also helps to kind of reinforce that there are certain required activities that have to be done once the collection is received.
And I'd say for my part, the way that I've really advocated for some of those changes is making it clear that this is providing overall more access to more pieces of our collection for them and for our patrons, and also constantly reminding people that processing is iterative, that this is not a one-and-done situation, that we have conversations that we can revisit, that different things are processed to different levels at different times, and those decisions are not made now and never revisited, but that this is an ongoing conversation, and it's an ongoing conversation based on how it's being used, how collection's being used, if it's being used, what the preservation needs are, and that they'll have they'll be part of that conversation at every step. So this is a way for us to provide much broader access at the time of acquisition, and then we continue conversations.
Those are great comments. Just to add to that, I use a lot of persistence. You know, in the case of these vendor-driven projects, like, there's just been so many like ideas of them over time, and it's been, you know, I've been in my position for 4.5 years, and I have just over time been able to insert myself into the process and use that persistence and keep a standard method or message that's like, no, this is work. This is work for people. This isn't just something that you're going to get the revenue from and nobody else is going to have to do anything about. Like, these are the steps that have to happen. And then, of course, when a project goes a little sideways, and I'm a very nice person, I promise, but I do sometimes say, like, if we had talked about this from the beginning, maybe we could have anticipated this, so at least when it does go sideways, we're not like, ah, it's crazy. We can say, like, oh, hey, we expected this, something like this to go sideways, now we're ready to deal with it. So persistence and standard and, like, consistent messaging.
So I think there are two more people up here, and I think that those will be our last two questions. But give us the luxury of time to be able to discuss with you all.
So my name is Molly, and I am a curator. I apologize on behalf of my entire profession. I'm kind
not
of
all curators.
I'm actually really kind of horrified by what I've heard here today, and I'm up here to kind of say a little bit about, I think, some different practices that occur at a lot of institutions, I hope, including my own. I'm a curator at the University of Virginia, I'm just blown away by the idea that curators don't pick up their own collections from people's houses. I pick them all up. I unpack them. I have, at many points, accessioned them. If I need something processed, I use my own student to do it because I know that our staff doesn't have time. There's a lot that I think has to happen on the part of curators at institutions that have a huge imbalance between collection development funds and staffing, and that's an issue for us. We have huge collection development funds, and that's great, but we're also required to spend them. And so I'm in the position of having to buy, even though I know that my colleagues don't have time to deal with what I bring in. And I know you haven't been talking about books, but books are a huge issue for us, because we tend to spend more money on books and get more archives as gifts, and that's a whole other issue. But there's a huge imbalance, and it means that I am, like, so thoroughly aware of the problem that I'm causing, but I have very little opportunity to do anything about it. We do have a couple of funds that we've been able to leverage for various things other than acquisitions, but for a lot of our funds, the language is written such that you can only use it to acquire. So until our administration tells us it's okay not to spend out your funds, you know, then we're kind of in a bind, and we find ourselves doing everything we possibly can to help from that side. One of the issues that I find is I don't have control over the level of processing. But actually, it's interesting that your answer is to the last question, because I find that often I would like to see things processed less thoroughly. I am perfectly happy with a box and folder list, but I don't make that decision. So sometimes I think there's a challenge when your processing department may have different ideas about standards than the curator. And that's a really interesting ongoing challenge. I'm a huge fan of Green Meissner. Woohoo! You know, but apparently that's not the case for a lot of curators. Like, I'd love to see our scrapbooks in finding aids and not with book records, and we actually do that. I also wanted to note that a lot of the problems that you're noting, I think, are really not the curators. I don't want to say fault, because they are. We should all be responsible. But I think there's a problem with the administrative structure of the organization. If the directors are accepting this as a curatorial model, there's a problem there with how your library is being run. Curators, if they're not being made responsible for their colleagues' work, then there's a real problem up above them. When I started my job at UVA, the director at the time, Nicole Boucher, at the same time that I and my co-curator were hired, instituted a collections committee that the two of us oversee, and we've been doing that for 6 years now. And any acquisition over a certain dollar amount, and not officially, and I'm trying, but over a certain size, has to go to that committee, and they're representatives of every department within special collections at those meetings. We do not make our decisions on our own, and it's a state accountability issue too. I mean, we can't be allowed to make those decisions by ourselves. So I just want to advocate for some serious thinking at the administrative level about how you allow your staff to behave to one another as professionals. And I'd also like to advocate for a session on positive relationships and positive manners in which curators and processing staff work together at institutions. Because these just, I mean, like I said, I'm appalled. I'm sure there are things that I do that infuriate my colleagues, but I'd like to believe that that we can do a lot better than this, and that many of us strive to and would love to hear some great positive ideas. Thanks.
Thanks. last question?
Just for another perspective, I'm Beth Ryan from Stanford Library's Conservation Department. So thanks for your talk. I found it really interesting. And just for like a really quick case study, many of the archival collections that we're getting in these days have non-paper materials, often composite plastic objects, architectural models, and all kinds of things that we don't have in-house expertise to handle. So we have to hire a consultant, perhaps, or another conservator. And just thinking about those things, I'm wondering how you see partnering with conservation and perhaps including them in this in your operations impact statement, and if you've done that, maybe what some of your experiences are, what they could be.
I have included conversations with conservators a few different times. One of them was that initial set of Polaroids. I did consult with someone in our conservation lab to talk about what would be needed to house those effectively. And I think that I see this that happen times where we talk with conservation. More often, I think it is talking to our digital library team about things like, do we have or can we allocate the digital storage space in our preservation repository to handle this? So I do use this as a tool for taking to other parts of the library who have some of those, you know, downstream activities that are being impacted by collections coming in, and we'll take that back and include that as a sort of line item in the form.
Yeah, I had a hallway conversation with our director of conservation a few days ago where we were just chatting. He's like, where are you headed? I'm in New Orleans for this conference. Oh, yeah, I'm giving a talk. What are you giving a talk about? And I told him, and he was like, yeah, he totally got it.
It's really nice to hear it. And there's so many issues like serving patrons. How do you serve patron architectural model that's, you know, 2 feet by 3 feet, and what is the process for that? How can we help make that happen? And further down the line, preparing things for exhibit, transporting them, you know, halfway around the world. And all those issues. So, thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.